Suspect Convictions is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/suspect to get started today.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. And this week, Scott, we're going to expand our storytelling of the death of three-year-old Christina McNeil in Bloomington, Illinois in 1998 with two special guests via Skype.
And they're wonderful guests. We have Aphrodite Jones, a world-renowned true crime expert and an author, and we have Bob Ruff, an experienced investigator and a top-notch podcaster. He produces the podcast Truth and Justice. We're just delighted to have both of them on board.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate being here.
Aphrodite is a veteran true crime TV reporter known for her coverage of high-profile cases such as those including Phil Spector and Michael Jackson and Scott Peterson. She's authored 8 books and is preparing to launch a new podcast about unsolved murders. She's asking for input from listeners in that regard, people who are urged to contact her website with leads, and that website is aphroditejones.com. Can you tell us any more about that project?
What I want to say to you guys is that I have had 20 years of looking at cold cases that have haunted me. And little by little now, with the new DNA and other capacities and forensics, these cases are now solvable. However, there is not the finances available to all of the smaller police departments around America who are working on cold cases. And often family members who have a homicide in their family and a case that's gone cold with no leads are just left with nothing and waiting. And I really want to help those families, those victims' families, in any way possible. And I'm putting a call out there, a shout out to anyone who's been touched by a murder, who feels it's gone cold, to please write to me through the contact page on my website. And yes, I plan to absolutely get involved in some of these cases and try to help solve them. I have a couple of people that are willing to help me, and they're big deal people. That's all I'm going to say for now.
Very well. And Bob Ruff, you have just begun this month on your podcast, Truth and Justice, a look at the forgotten West Memphis 3, focusing on 3 8-year-old boys who were murdered in East Arkansas back in 1993. 3 teenagers were later convicted in connection with the deaths, which continue to swirl in controversy. Tell us a little bit about the forgotten West Memphis 3.
Well, we're calling this season, it's our season 5 of the show, the Forgotten 3, because we've never done a case that's been really highly publicized. We are kind of, MO has always been to try to, much like Aphrodite was just talking about, try to find people that need help that don't have the resources to get that help. So we've always turned down requests to cover high-profile cases. But in this case, I study wrongful convictions all the time in hopes to learn how they happen and pick up on patterns and things like that. And in my studying of the West Memphis 3 case, this whole journey began because when I finished watching the 3-part documentary Paradise Lost, so it's 6 hours of documentary that spans over a decade, and I realized I didn't know the 3 victims' names. I'm sure they had been said during the documentaries, but I watched all of them and didn't even know their names and realized that no one, with all the publicity that has come with this case, there's never been any focus on the 3 victims, Michael Moore, Christopher Byers, and Stevie Branch. And so I started digging into it a little bit more, and I really just felt led to give them a voice. And that's why we're calling them the Forgotten West Memphis 3. And our intention is not just to tell the story, but to do what we do, which is engage the efforts of, we have several hundred thousand listeners that listen to the show, and we use a unique crowdsourcing model where week by week we go through the investigation and engage the listeners to help. It's been very successful in the past, and we believe that by engaging this methodology that we will be able to hopefully finally bring closure to everyone whose lives have been destroyed by this case and solve the murder of the case known as the West Memphis 3.
What a cool idea. I love that idea. In fact, we're doing something similar with our podcast. I haven't seen anybody do this before, but we're going to open up to the listeners the chance to ask the defendant in this case, Barton McNeil, any question they want to ask. They've been listening to podcast for, you know, for three episodes now, and I'm sure a lot of them are like me, and they sit back and say, well, why didn't he ask this question, or why didn't he ask that question? Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is we're going to open it up, and people can write in to askbart@suspectconvictions.com and ask him any question they want to ask him, and then we'll get him on the phone, and we will ask those questions of him. And so it's a really good way for, I think, for listeners to get engaged and involved and that sort of thing. But you guys have both listened to the first three episodes. What ran through your mind, Aphrodite, when you were listening to them?
Well, first and foremost, Bloomington, Illinois, back 20 years ago, we have to set that in our mind as something that's affecting this investigation. And the idea that, they didn't have crime back then, they didn't have a murder history in that town back then, they probably didn't have a homicide department or detectives who knew what they were doing. And I think that's evident in the calls we hear in the background when, this poor man, Bart, is calling in and asking for a homicide investigator. And at some point when he calls three times, you hear the detective say, "What's his problem?" And for me, that just never will leave my mind. What's his problem? His problem is his child is dead and she's 3 years old and nobody's paying attention to the fact that he believes he's found evidence of a murder. I mean, how can you possibly, be reporting, and he says it loud and clear, "I believe that my child was murdered." And in a small town like that, where really basically nothing's going on besides a stolen bicycle, or, I'm guessing again, it's 20 years ago, there weren't a whole lot of murders, a whole lot of three-year-olds being murdered at the time in that town. How can they not have jumped on this? How could they have been so lackadaisical about those phone calls? I mean, they're calling it or thought of it as an unnatural or rather a natural death and not a priority. Apparently, he gave the wrong phone number initially. He gave the wrong address. So there's that. That's part of the problem of police not getting there. But still and all, the careless way, if you will, the I don't know if you call it careless and carefree, whichever one, but the detective had a sense in my mind that the voice was saying basically, this is a chore that I have to get to, like, oh yeah, I'm going to get to it, not this is a major crime that I need to go investigate. And that's a serious issue at the jump with this case.
Yeah, and before we get to Bob, I want to say something here just to kind of set the record straight a little bit. We have not actually checked the murder rate, what it was 20 years ago in Bloomington. The reference in the opening episode about that really came from a question that Scott asked me about anecdotally about how was Bloomington 20 years ago compared to now. Bloomington has changed a little bit, but by and large, the size of the community is pretty much the same, a little bit larger. There weren't three-year-old dead babies common 20 years ago, so there was not that. But we still did have a few murders. The police department has changed a little bit since then, but not a whole lot. There is still no homicide division or anything like that. They do handle a few murders, as they did back then. I guess I just need to set the record straight a little bit here that the city of Bloomington Normal, it's a Twin City community, is not tremendously different than it was 20 years ago, but there are some changes.
Yeah, and it's important to remember, Bloomington's a very white-collar community. Illinois State University is headquartered here. Traditionally, it's thought of as a college town.
This is the headquarters of State Farm Insurance.
State Farm Insurance and Country Financial are headquartered here. So it's a very, it's a prosperous community. It's, what would you say, about 100,000?
Overall, I would say it's close to 130,000
people. 130,000
people. And 20 years ago, it was probably around 110,000.
Okay. So, it's a nice community, very comfortable, but it's not a place where if you are a homicide detective, you're going to get a lot of practice. I shouldn't even say a homicide detective. Just say a detective wouldn't get much practice on homicides because I don't think they have anybody designated to be a homicide detective here. How about you, Bob? You come from an investigation background. What was your reaction when you were listening to those 911 tapes?
Well, my issue with it is that you just don't have a baseline. A big part of what I do is doing, behavior analysis and statement analysis and things like that. And And you guys had pointed out that, you know, it sounded to you like you heard a desperate man. And it sounded the same to me. But the problem is I don't know anything about this guy or, you know, what's his baseline or anything like that. And so I listened to it several times, and I would go back and forth, like, is this someone acting, or is this genuinely a man in hysterics over his daughter? And I don't know. I can't pretend to know the difference, but it's definitely extremely compelling. And then to speak to what Aphrodite had mentioned, it to me, I had a similar reaction, slightly different in the fact that it seemed to me that probably based on the fact that this city doesn't have a high crime rate and certainly not a high murder rate, it seemed to me like something was getting lost in translation from the dispatcher to the detectives. One thing that I had noticed when the dispatcher called the detective on the phone and said, "This guy's calling you, wants to talk to you about this murder," and you could, and to me it sounded like the detective was confused. He was like, "What are you talking about? What murder? Because, you know, from the initial response and report earlier that day, it was, you know, the child was found dead in her bed, and Christina just, they had thought, I believe, that it was just natural causes. So I think he was confused as to why they were calling it a murder. But certainly it didn't get the attention that it deserved once he requested that someone come out, that he has information or has found evidence that he believes that his child was murdered.
This is the thing that gets me, that I really struggle with. Okay, if you were the person who killed this little girl, and the initial evaluation by the police and the medical examiners there are, this is a natural cause of death, would you be picking up the phone over and over again and dialing 911 and saying, "My daughter's been murdered, I found evidence"? Or would you be like laying low and thinking, maybe they'll just keep thinking it's a natural cause of death?
Certainly the natural reaction I have is absolutely you would lay low. You're certainly not going to call for investigators if they think it's a natural death, especially back in those days. Hey, let's sweep it all under the rug. But there is another issue that I have with this, and having kind of looked forward in this case, which is that Bart apparently had records and court documentation that showed that his girlfriend, this Miss Sook Wang, had a violent past. And apparently there's evidence in court that she not only had battery incidents on her record, domestic battery, but that included patterns of abuse against Bart McNeil and her own daughter, her daughter, Michelle. And so my question then is, who is Bart McNeil? Because if there are patterns of abuse documented against him by this woman and documented again in court against her child, then why is he allowing her to be anywhere near his 3-year-old? Especially, and this is the thing that gets me, is that she called him, according to Bart, that night at around 10:30 p.m. to ask about him, about his daughter, where is his daughter, was she asleep? And he gives her that information. Now, this is from him, from his own words, that he tells this crazy woman, this documented criminal, that his daughter is asleep in a particular room when she calls at 10:30 at night. Now, this is, again, at a time when he's trying to break up with her. They've had a fight, and he's giving this crazy person this information. Why would he do that? I mean, that to me is, again, who is Barton McNeil? He allows this woman to be abusive toward him. He knows she has a record. He can't seem to break up with her. And now she calls oddly at 10:30 at night and is asking questions about his daughter?
Exactly. I mean, and you, the questions you're asking are the same ones my wife asks when I get home. Like, well, why on earth would you allow somebody who you know is violent to be anywhere near your child? I mean, that doesn't make sense to, you know, and I agree. I mean, you know, when I talked to Bart, he said, you know, he had so much invested in the relationship, he just didn't want to just throw it away. And you know, I will say this. I believe that there was no documented evidence or of child abuse against her older daughter until after the situation with the little girl Christina happened. Bart had been the target of domestic abuse. In fact, he was supposed to testify against her. They broke up the day before he was supposed to testify in court against her. And she keeps calling him that night. I mean, it strikes me as really weird. Like, why are you still having contact with this woman you're testifying against the next day?
Well, and here's the follow-up question that I have to this, which is really the crux of my now issue with all of this. Because on the surface, Bart McNeil is, in my mind, totally innocent and has been wrongfully convicted. And the Innocence Project and everyone else needs to get on this and get this poor man out of prison that he spent 19 years of his life. However, the thing is, he tells police that he got that call at 10:30 at night. He later, when he finds his child not breathing, gets the police back for wants a homicide investigation, wants forensics there. But what I don't understand is the window fan was already knocked onto the ground and police had seen it and Bart had seen it. So why wouldn't he, under the guise of knowing that this woman is violent, knowing that he's trying to get rid of her, knowing that she's called the night before asking about his daughter, knowing that she's jealous, resentful, whatever she is. I mean, there have to be issues that she was beating up on Bart. Why wouldn't he immediately jump to the conclusion the next day when he's saying it's a murder on the phone to the police that it was this woman, that it was Masuk? I just find there's a lapse there, a gap there that doesn't make sense.
Well, what he says when I've talked to him about this is, you know, when he found the body that morning, you know, the first thing that was on his mind is, let's get an ambulance here. Let's get this taken care of. And then he said he went and he noticed that his ex-girlfriend's Masuk's car is sitting outside their apartment. And outside his apartment, he's like, what's going on here? But, you know, he said then he's dealing with his ex-wife and they're consoling each other and there's just so much going on. And he said his ex-wife is the first to suggest, you know, maybe this was a murder. I mean, you think that she could have been involved here? And he said, you know, and then
that exactly goes to my point.
Yeah. And then
why didn't he see that immediately? Why did it take the next day?
No, it wasn't the next day. It was later that afternoon. It was later that afternoon that he started making the calls.
Hours later.
Yeah, okay. I agree.
I mean, there's something about that piece of the puzzle that really, as now I'm finding out that he was about to testify against her that day about domestic violence charges against her.
Yes.
Him. I mean, how do you not put that together immediately?
It would seem to me like that would be something really worth asking. In fact, why don't we, in a future episode, take that question that you just posed and ask Bart that question? If we go with everything that Bart has told us is true, at the very least, he's somebody who took a very dangerous person and put her in the presence of his daughter. That doesn't show very good judgment in my mind.
There's another thing that's weird, which is, in studying this thing, Bart later believes, once he decides that Masuk is the perpetrator and killed his child, he says that he was sleeping and he thinks he heard his daughter say the name Michelle. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that now his theory became that Masuk and her child entered the house and or her child was outside the window, one or the other, and that hence, his child, Christina, could hear or knew or had some utterance of the name Michelle. How does that suddenly enter the picture? Wouldn't he have immediately said this upon finding his child deceased? After the emergency, couldn't save her, all of that? I mean, I don't get it.
Yeah, and those are all the questions I'm asking, too, and I agree with you. I mean, those are some red flags in my mind. I mean, or I shouldn't say red flags, just big question marks. Like, what's going on here? I mean, what was he thinking? I mean, I don't know. Bob, you were a firefighter for a long time. You've been mm-hmm. to pretty traumatic scenes. I mean, do people always think rationally when you get there? What's your experience?
Well, everybody's different. There's no right or wrong way to react to any of these things. And speaking of that, to get back to your original question as far as would you call police, a lot of what you, and to be clear, I'm kind of the skeptic amongst all skeptics, you know, because, and that's based on for the last 3 years, you know, every month I get, you know, 100 or so cases sent into me that I have to screen. And so I always try to look at them very closely when I'm screening these cases. And so when I'm looking at this one, you know, that question comes up, why would you call police when you're looking at, and let's call it post-offense behavior, if you're looking at Bart as a possible suspect, would you call police to tell them that there's been a murder if you, in fact, were the one who murdered them? And the answer to that is you just don't know. Again, it could very well be that he came home and looked around and thought, goodness, my wife, my daughter has been murdered. But it's also not an uncommon forensic countermeasure for a suspect to immediately try to point the police in a different direction. I mean, certainly they would have told him, I've been at many child deaths over my career, unfortunately, and he would have been told right away that, you know, we're going to send her for an autopsy, and given the manner that she died, he would know that they're going to find out real quickly that this wasn't an accidental death. And so a lot of the behaviors that we're talking about here, they could, and I'm not saying they are one way or the other, but something that needs to at least be considered is, are these forensic countermeasures? You know, the call from Masuk at 10:30 at night, well, was that ever confirmed by anyone? Or is that just what he said? Was that confirmed by phone records? Her car being parked outside, was that ever confirmed by anyone else? You know, a lot of, you know, there's two distinct things that are happening here. It's clear that Christine was foul play and that she was murdered. There's no question there. There was a crime. And so his behavior with everything pointing towards Masuk either means she is a very viable alternate suspect, or it's a series of forensic countermeasures if you're looking at an actual offender who's trying to find the best way out of this and comes up with a plan being we're going to blame it on the ex-girlfriend, and then all of his actions follow that plan. And so it could be either way, but I don't think the fact that he called police should be, you know, set in stone as one way or the other, either that he is guilty or innocent, because I think it could be either way. And even his phone call to 911 with the hysterics, it very well could be he's acting, or it could be he's distraught because he just found his daughter dead. So for me, as I'm looking at this, I'm trying to keep an open mind to both sides, and both of these are options.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We're joined today by two veteran true crime reporters, Aphrodite Jones and Bob Ruff.
Folks, I've been hiring people for the last 20-some years. It's difficult. I have interviewed so many candidates that I liked, but then found out were really bad matches once they came to work for me. And I missed some really quality people who applied, but just didn't have the right thing on the resume that they could have put on there. It's really difficult to hire the right person for the right job. That's why I like ZipRecruiter. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. And you can get over 100 postings out there on the internet. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting so they receive the best possible matches. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. just go to ZipRecruiter.com/suspect. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/suspect.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We're joined today by two veteran true crime reporters, Aphrodite Jones and Bob Ruff.
How about the window evidence? I mean, do you put much credence in it, Bob, or what's your thought?
From the sounds of it, there's a couple of things, and you guys are doing a great job reporting this, and I found the first three episodes enthralling. I was traveling back from New York yesterday and was listening to all of them, and when you covered the window, but it seems it's inconclusive. Meaning, you know, originally the police said, well, there's spider webs on the screen, so it couldn't have been removed. And then we have a spider web expert that says, well, they could build a web, you know, in less than 24 hours overnight. But then that same expert said that when he looked at those photos, in his opinion, they looked like they had been there for more than a day. So it's inconclusive. Whether or not they were the screen was broken or not. But, you know, for me, when I'm screening a case, I'm always, if there is a wrongful conviction, I always feel that you should be able to identify how that happened, how the person was wrongfully convicted, where the system went wrong pretty quickly. And there should be at least a viable alternative theory that makes more sense. Because typically it's the simple solution, not always, but typically it is. And so that's why I've been really struggling with this case is, the alternate theory is that his ex-girlfriend cuts the window screen, takes the screen out, climbs in, and I guess we'll get into the sexual assault part in a bit, but smothers and kills his daughter, sneaks back out, puts the screen back in. I don't think the window fan is an issue because the window was closed, and I have one of those window fans or had one. And if you're going to close your window, you have to take the fan out and put it down in order to close the window. So I assumed that was, and I think you had mentioned something briefly in the podcast that, you know, that's easily explainable why the window fan was down. But the big thing is when we start looking at, could this be, you know, the questions like you posed, like, could this be done by a woman? Would a woman do this? Are these things possible? We have to look at, so is the alternate theory plausible? And I'm not saying it's not, but it doesn't sound probable to me, because one thing that I don't think that's really been addressed yet is the fact that in my mind I keep picturing a small baby, but in fact this was a three-year-old that can walk and talk and scream and yell, and so the idea that there was no noise made, I mean, I remember when my son Parker was 3 years old trying to get a Band-Aid off his leg and he was afraid it was going to hurt, and he almost pinned me in a wrestling move. It's amazing how strong they can get when they fear pain, even at 3 years old. So the fact that there's no sound, or at least of a struggle coming from Christina from the other room, is interesting. And then the fact that the mistook supposedly knew his routine, which his routine was to often sleep in the same bed as Christina, for Barton to sleep in the same bed with her. I mean, the risk there is just incredible. To cut a screen, open the screen, crawl in. There's the sexual assault issue, then the murder, and then crawl back up to do all that while Barton was what, 10 feet away, 15 feet away in another room? The likelihood, in my opinion, of that happening and not getting caught, regardless of her violent history and all the things that are what would be circumstantial evidence, the idea for that to happen, it would have to be the perfect crime, the perfect set of scenario circumstances, which it very well could have been. But this case definitely, if I was screening this case from the information I've seen so far, would definitely have me thinking twice whether this was a case of actual innocence. However, I'd like to add the caveat, the fact that the Innocence Project believes that Barton McNeil is innocent holds a lot of weight with me, because I know that their screening process is just as grueling, if not more grueling than mine. So I assume they have reasons for believing that he is actual innocent, because they don't just take any case.
But you, Aphrodite, what's your reaction to the window evidence?
First and foremost, shades of JonBenet Ramsey come to mind. You know, the whole idea that there are cobwebs and that means no one could have broken in, when in fact we know, and through your etymologist, we've discovered that cobwebs can be formed, within a half hour to an hour. They can also, this one in particular was probably formed overnight. That then we have to throw out the idea that no one entered through the window because of a cobweb, in my mind. Now, I know that your expert also said that they looked thicker. The cobweb in the grainy footage looked thicker, meaning that it perhaps was built over a period of days, which then changes the intruder theory with the cobweb. So I'm not saying throw it out, but I am saying that it's very iffy to exclude an intruder based on a cobweb, especially a grainy cobweb from 20 years ago in video footage. That said, the two holes that are made in that screen, which are near the latch, which would allow someone to enter and exit from the window, you know, that to me speaks volumes, especially now when we discover after the fact that this same crazy person, this psychopath, this killer, went and murdered her mother-in-law in a horrible way at the same time that she was having marital difficulties with him. So that there's this pattern for her, this Misuk person, to when she is being dumped, when she is being fearful that her love interest is going to leave her, to not only act out, but to exact revenge upon her significant other to the extent that she kills their most beloved person. In the case of Barton, it's his daughter who he loves more than anything in life. It's his only child. And in the case of her husband, it was his mother. And, you know, but you can't ignore now the fact that this woman is in prison for murder, and not only murder, but the worst type of possible premeditated, thought out, you know, point by point murder plot against her mother-in-law, where she lured this woman to a location. And then not only did she kill her, but she actually buried the body with her own son in the car. Now, that to me goes to the level of a complete sociopath, psychopath. There is nothing about this woman, Misuk, her name, that tells me that she's not capable of cold-blooded murder of a child that is the love of her soon-to-be ex-boyfriend's life. And so to that end, I have to see what opportunity did Misuk have to enter that house. What evidence could there be that the Innocence Project claim there is now to link Misuk to that murder? And furthermore, to question if this guy, Bart, was on the internet, was on, you know, was distracted, had headphones on. I don't know the particulars, and I don't know any of us do, but he could have been distracted enough that it didn't have to have the headphones on. It could have been loud enough for her to have entered silently. And remember, that child was asleep. So kicking and screaming is all well and good, but when somebody is asleep and somebody else enters, you know, like the itsy bitsy creepy spider that she is, that child didn't have stand a chance. You could put that child out with strangulation, which is what the cause of death was, pretty quickly with a pillow, and nothing would be heard.
What's interesting to me is if she did this, it would have had to be intricately planned. I mean, it's a complicated plan to, you know, climb up on a ladder or climb up on a bucket and cut your hole in the screen, slip in there quietly so that the guy in the other room who has headphones on and listen to music and is on the internet talking to women, you can do this and get away with it. I mean, it's very complicated. And generally, I mean, I've been a reporter for 30 years. I stay away from complicated and try to look for the most simple solution. But when you look at the murder that we know that she did commit 12 years later, that was an incredibly complicated murder. I mean, she paid somebody to pose as a Chinese student and who happened to speak Mandarin to, and then she lured her down to Bloomington from Chicago and then, you know, attacked her in a parking lot and hauled her body and boxed it up. And I mean, there was a lot going on. I mean, she even had a friend from church come over and help her lift the box up and into her in the back of her SUV, telling her it was full of china. I mean, there's a lot of here that we know that she did that. Gosh, it took some real audacity and some really careful planning to get it done. So,
well, it's outrageous lengths that this woman went to in the case of murdering her mother-in-law, and it speaks to a pathological mind, the mind of a killer. And everything about that case, including the fact that she took steps to cover it up, okay, all harken back for me to the murder of Christina McNeil. Because again, when you talk about the window, there was this screen which was, you know, very flimsily held to the window frame. And that to me indicates that somebody attempted to cover their tracks by placing the screen back over that window, but they needed to get out fast so it wasn't secured. Now, if Bart had done this, why in the world wouldn't he have secured that window screen onto the window? Why would he leave any, you know, I don't know. Maybe he wants to make it look like there was somebody else, an intruder. It reeks to me. It really reeks. And I think I have to, you know, defer to Bob on this and say, we're at a crossroads with this case, because anything that Bart would or would not have done is also dependent on, you know, his trying to control the crime scene, or the scene at the time, his trying to, you know, have the upper hand over what the police are and are not going to pursue forensically. You know, does he know that because his child died of a quote unquote natural death, that there wouldn't be an autopsy regardless, that his wife wouldn't have called for an autopsy regardless? You know, maybe he wants to get a jump on that and be the one who's asking for this so that later he can come back and say, would I call the police on myself? Would I call for a forensics team? No. And that's exactly his argument. So it's tricky.
Bob, I'm going to go into the touchy area now. Did a sexual assault happen? What are you thinking, Bob?
I think that it did happen. And, you know, and I understand there's a new expert that possibly didn't. But what I know is, before listening to that, I was just reading the handwritten autopsy report, which I found interesting that it was a handwritten autopsy report. But what I noticed, what it said when they inspected the genital area, that there was edema and blood when they did the swabs of the vaginal cavity. And edema is one thing that was mentioned, that a common occurrence after death is the swelling, but in fact, it's not exactly accurate. You have to have blood flow for swelling, based on my medical training. Now, again, I'll default to a doctor at any time, but the word edema is what caught my attention, because what does happen after death is dilation. Any orifice that has any kind of muscle that holds it closed, and it's actually something we're dealing with in the West Memphis 3 case now, too. Upon death, there will be dilation of these orifices, meaning they'll widen. But the fact that there was swelling and blood certainly seems to be an indication that there was some kind of sexual assault. However, it's such an awful subject to talk about, but I guess we kind of have to. But the fact that the hymen was intact, that there wasn't any deep penetration, something happened to this girl, to her genital area. I guess the short answer to your question is, I do believe there was some kind of sexual assault. And I don't think that it's necessarily the most accurate theory that there was a sexual assault and then a murder to cover it up. I think that more likely scenario is something that, like Aphrodite had mentioned earlier, how quickly the child could be quieted with a pillow over the face, that it could have been a pillow over the face to keep her quiet during the sexual assault. And then all of a sudden the individual, whoever it was doing it, realizes she's not moving and she's dead, meaning that the murder could have been an accident because the killer was trying to actually sexually assault her and keep her quiet. I think that's at least a hypothesis that has to be considered.
How about you, Aphrodite? Do you think a sexual assault took place?
Well, as queasy as it makes me to talk about this and to even think about it, I also, you know, looked at this and noted the bleeding around the vulva, which is indication of sexual abuse that took place. And I know that there was no penetration because the hymen was in place. However, you know, what I found really bizarre, again, with Barton McNeil, is the fact that he made unusual comments. He accused, he asked, as you've said on your podcast here, that he asked to be able to interrogate Masuk himself, because he made a remark initially that Masuk probably used one of her vibrators on his daughter. Well, that's a strange thing to come out with, you know, out of the blue. I just, again, if he didn't initially, if he needed to have his wife tell him that she believed Masuk was the killer or was the perpetrator here, why would he not have immediately mentioned this idea that Masuk had vibrators around, that she would have possibly sexually violated this child? Why did it take time for him to come up with this idea that he was going to get a confession out of Masuk that she molested his daughter and probably used one of her vibrators on Christina? That is just so off the charts weird. And I know he meant well, and I know we're back in time, but let's face it, back in time, there was plenty of investigations that went right. I don't know why the police would allow him to interrogate her, except about his insistence. But then what happened, of course, is that she then had the opportunity, if in fact a vibrator was used, to go and clean them all. And the police, who didn't know what they were doing, clearly back there in that town, decided after the fact to go and collect the vibrators, which of course would have no evidence on them now because they would have been the opportunity to have been cleaned. So, but just the idea that the first thing that comes to your mind is your girlfriend assaulted your child with one of her vibrators. What?
And the timing there is interesting too, and maybe I misheard, but didn't that interview with Masuk, did I hear that correctly, that took place that night or within 24 hours?
It was the next day. I believe it was right after the autopsy had been performed the next day that they confronted Bart with evidence that she'd been that his daughter had been sexually assaulted, and then he said, "Well, you know, I think it must have been Masuk who did this." And then they ended up in the same. And he said, "Put me in the same room with her. I'll get her to confess." Which I have. Right. I've been a reporter for a long time. I have never, ever, ever heard of putting two people in the same room to confront each other like that. Have you guys?
No, me never.
Never.
No way. Yeah, I mean, it just struck me as bizarre. I mean, there's a lot of things about this case that's bizarre. But Bart's statement, right out of the blue, that accusing her of doing that, I thought was weird, too. I mean, it's really hard to get a handle on this. I mean, it's just...
Again, we go back to... I'm sorry to interrupt. This makes me crazy because I'm going back to the idea that why would this man allow this crazy woman near his three-year-old who, remember, he does not have custody of? This is his cherished time with her. Why would he allow this crazy woman who is beating him physically, okay, who is a monster, obviously, and he has to know it, near his three-year-old, and then admit or have the notion that she's got vibrators around that she would have attacked the child with? I mean, how does that even fit?
I've been trying to wrap my head around this for months, and there's things like that that just, like, wow, I don't know the answer to that. I mean,
I'd like to know what information was given to him after the autopsy. I mean, because it could be another very shortfall of the police if they gave him all the exact details. But if they told him that she had been sexually assaulted, I would like to know, did he know the exact injuries, exactly what was found? because he certainly was able to describe his theory of exactly how that would have happened in a way that doesn't fit with the injuries. Now, if they had told him these were the injuries like this, this is what we think, then sure, in your mind you come up with a hypothesis what could fit that. But if all they told him was there's signs of sexual assault, and then he comes out and describes something that someone else could have done that would have caused those exact same injuries, that would be another big red flag.
So let me ask this question. If you guys had two questions to ask Bart, what questions would you ask him? I'll have two each. You want to start, Aphrodite?
There's an indication that Bart believed his daughter had been suffocated, and that he said this before the cause of death was determined in an autopsy. How would he know that? That would be one question that I want to know. And I want to know why he changed his story about what he was doing when Christina died or was killed. Because at one time he said he was on a computer, and another time, I believe he said he was sleeping. And for me, that's a big deal, a very big deal. I get it when you find a child dead that you can be confused and give wrong addresses and give wrong information and not know and later come up with you think somebody murdered this child and all the rest of it. But when you, prior to an act of violence like this, when everything is quote unquote normal, how is it that you don't know what you were doing? I mean, why would you change what you were doing and have a couple different scenarios there? Unless you were trying to cover something up. That's what I want to know. What I'd ask him. And also, how did he come to the conclusion that she was suffocated? I mean, I get it that she wasn't breathing, so perhaps, you know, it's an obvious conclusion. But why would you come out and tell the police that? How do you know she wasn't strangled? I mean, if you're calling 911 in such a panic as he was, and she was breathing, please come, help. Either she's dead or she's not. We're not sure in that call because he wants help, help, help. Wants to save her. And then yet he later determines in his mind that she was suffocated. He knows this before an autopsy is revealed. I mean, aren't there things such as, you know, I know that SIDS may not apply to a 3-year-old, but I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities as a cause of death. It's not certainly not something that I would jump to is that my child was strangled.
In fairness to Bart on this, I will say this. He said, you know, we don't know what time she was murdered. We know that he was up till like 2 or 3 in the morning with his headphones on, listening to music, talking to women on the internet. Then, I should say chatting with typing. Back in those days, they didn't really have where you could talk audibly to people. So he was doing that. Then he went to sleep. So he could have been on the computer when this murder happened, if you go with his story, or he could have been asleep. We don't know exactly what time of day.
Yes, to Bob's point, which was just important here and playing devil's advocate, I want to believe that Bart is innocent, and I frankly do believe it. I believe that Misook, in her later actions, gave us the answers. However, we don't know. Because back in those days, we don't have any records of him, whether or not he was on a phone, whether or not he was on a computer, whether or not he had a headphone on, whether he didn't. I mean, all of that is his story. And I underline that because how convenient that during the time that his daughter was murdered, he was oblivious because he was so caught up in a computer and headphones and everything else that he does not hear, you know. And again, like I say, both sides of the coin are, sure, she could have snuck in if he was that distracted. However, why then would he allow this crazy woman to know where his daughter is sleeping when she called him allegedly at 10:30 at night that night? That is the part. That just sticks with me.
How about you, Bob? What questions would you ask Bart?
Well, I think Aphrodite has some really good ones. And for me, I think there's really only one aside from that I'd want to ask. And a lot of that is due to the fact that I just, from as much as I've done this type of work and investigating and interviewing, I find that it's bad form to just believe everything people tell you. So
sure.
If it can't be backed up. But a question I would want to ask is, what exactly triggered him to believe that this was a homicide. Because there was, if I understand correctly, Christina had a history of some sort of respiratory problems. But in any case, you find your child dead in her room with the windows closed, 20 feet from you, or however far, not far from where you were at all night. I feel like most people would assume that this was natural causes. To make the leap to call police back and say that this was a murder before there's any, he doesn't know, like Aphrodite said, doesn't know the cause of death, doesn't know anything. Just what triggered him to even think, before he even came to how he thought she was killed, but the fact that he thought this was a murder? Because it's, you have to admit, if this was someone else, if this was Masuk or anyone else, it's a pretty damn bizarre set of circumstances for someone to, as far as a crime for someone to commit. It's insane for someone to do this. More so insane than most murders, which are all insane. So to make that leap when you have her in her own bedroom, found in her bed, right where you left her, and there's no sign of forced entry other than what he later finds, these cuts on the screens, what caused him to all of a sudden make that leap that he believes that there was a murder and foul play? I would like to know the answer to that question, because it just, I would expect a grieving father dealing with, you know, Christina's mother and other family members and wrapped in grief, and he's in there doing a forensic analysis of the crime scene. And I also do want to point out that, you know, I very much agree with what Aphrodite said. Is to me, something really stinks when all of the circumstances are perfectly wrapped up into a neat little package the way they were. Oh, I was on headphones. I wasn't paying attention. There was allegedly a call where she, I mean, as we said, it's kind of been posed as, how odd was it for Masuk to call him and ask where Christina was sleeping? Well, it is very odd. Either that was a very odd call she made, or it's very odd that someone would tell that story unless they're trying to create a narrative of how this crime could happen, because the only way that it could happen would be if Masuk, if she was the offender here, did know where she was sleeping and did know that Barton was not in the bed with her. So how does that happen? She must have called and asked this strange series of questions. I just, in my opinion, again, and I want to preface this again by saying that, you know, I really put a lot of faith into the Innocence Project and their work and their screening process, and that weighs heavy on me. My personal opinion from what I've seen so far is I personally, sadly, think the most likely situation here is that Barton, my particular hypothesis is that during the process of a sexual assault, accidentally killed his daughter, is what I believe happened. But that's just an opinion based on the tiny little bit of information we have right now, and I'm really excited to see where you guys go from here. I'm really enjoying the podcast. I'm really enjoying your coverage of the case. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot more that we're going to learn as the case moves along.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate you taking your time for us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. This is really one of the most interesting murder cases and question of guilt, question of innocence. I just have so many doubts about both of these people in this story. And I really, really, truly hope that we come to the right conclusion, that you guys can get to the bottom of it.
Hey, maybe it's something you want to come back in a future year and do a television program on.
You never know.
Thanks to both of our guests, noted true crime reporter Aphrodite Jones and Bob Ruff, host of the Truth and Justice podcast. Next week, during Suspect Convictions, we try to better learn who is Masuk. You'll hear from, among others, one of her ex-husbands.
There's a good side to her. There's more to it than just somebody that snapped, that had a bad childhood, that killed an elderly lady. She did have a good heart.
That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.